I'm Jeff Booth, and this is Sex Science Sunday here on the Jeff Booth Show, brought to you by the Center for Sexual Expression and Education. And this week it's just going to be a mixed bag of different interesting stories. And the first one's interesting, comes out of the University of Rochester, and I suspect will be quite controversial, but I do not find their findings surprising. So basically, a team of psychologists from the Israeli-based Interdisciplinary Center Herzliya, probably not saying that right, and the University of Rochester's Department of Clinical and Social Sciences in Psychology did a study about sex and the initiation of romantic relationships. Now, as a swinger, someone who has an open marriage and has had sexual relationships with a lot of different people, you know, I come at this from a little different perspective than most people would. But here's what their study concluded. They said that sexual desire may play a major role not only in attracting potential partners to each other, but also in encouraging the formation of an attachment between them to begin with. According to the study's lead author, Gurit Birnbaum, and I quote, "Sex may set the stage for deepening the emotional connection between strangers. This holds true for both men and women. Sex motivates human beings to connect regardless of gender." Now, this study was limited to heterosexuals, and some believe that men are more likely than women to initiate relationships when sexually aroused. But they focused on more subtle relationship-initiating strategies, such as providing help. And they found that the pattern doesn't hold true. In fact, both men and women try to connect with potential partners when sexually aroused. Kind of makes sense. So they had four interrelated studies, and participants were introduced to a new acquaintance of the opposite sex in a face-to-face encounter. The researchers found that sexual desire triggers behavior that can promote emotional bonding during these encounters. According to Harry Rice, a co-author, "Although sexual urges and emotional attachments are distinct feelings, evolutionary and social processes likely have rendered humans particularly prone to becoming romantically attached to partners to whom they are sexually attracted." Of course, that makes complete sense. Now, in my world, which I know is different from most people's, but I have sex with people before I really get to know them in general. But through that sex, I often become closer to them or more bonded, and I get to know them better over time. And I have many sex partners and former sex partners who I'm still close with and friends with and have what I feel is a deep relationship. Not the same as the one I have with my wife, but still a relationship that is very meaningful. So this study makes perfect sense to me. So I don't know if you've spent a lot of time thinking about intravaginal ejaculation latency time, but it is an interesting topic, and in 2005, the Journal of Sexual Medicine did publish a multinational population survey of intravaginal ejaculation latency time. Now, that's the amount of time between when you put a penis inside a vagina and then you ejaculate. Now, the appalling, pathetic number that they got from 500 couples across five countries was 5.4 minutes. Now, what that means is, yes, some were much longer than that, but that means that a whole bunch of others were even shorter than that. Yikes! And what brings this up is this is the data that was cited in a New York Times editorial that was one of the worst that Times has done, and they have no shortage of really horrible opinion page articles. So this op-ed was by a man named Paul Greenberg. There's actually lots of Paul Greenbergs, but this is the one who's a fellow at the Safina Center, which, you know, theoretically does important work in bringing together science, art, and literature to inspire a deeper connection with nature. And his op-ed was titled "In Search of Lost Scream Time," and he's no fan of smartphones. He writes a lot of kind of really bizarre things. He claims that the average American spent $1,380 on their smartphone and other mobile devices. I'm not sure how he gets to that figure. He also said they spent 1,460 hours. That's quite a deal. That's like a buck an hour. And he thinks that's bad. And he claims that in most Western states, for $1,380, you could buy half an acre of land. Yeah, that would be half an acre of land that no one wants in a place no one wants to live. I live in L.A. For that kind of money here, I could probably buy a plot of land the size of a brick. I says what we should do after buying that land is plant 150 trees. But here's what's really dumb about that. That's the West, where we have no water, global climate change at all. So by the time you've planted these trees in the cheap land that nobody wants in the middle of nowhere, you're going to have to water them. And that's going to cost you a whole lot more money. Then he cites a study from 2016 where it concluded that 29% of Americans would rather give up sex for 3 months than give up their smartphone for 1 week. We talked about that study when it came out and explained why you might want to question it. And he claims that, you know, people who are dependent on their smartphone have relationship uncertainty. Okay, I haven't seen any data that would make me completely convinced. Could be, might not be, I don't know. At the same time, I know a lot of people who used their smartphone to meet the person that they fell in love with. So, and if they don't meet somebody, they can use the smartphone to wank off with. But here's where he jumps into completely dumb territory. He's referring to that study about giving up sex for 3 months, and he says, now flip that around. If you give up your device for a year, you would have time to make love about 16,000 times. Assuming you're like most Americans and your love-making sessions last an average of 5.4 minutes, not counting foreplay. Whoa, I need to look at his math. So that's a total of 86,400 minutes that we're talking about that. So divide that by 60, that's 1,440 hours, or about 47 days. Okay, we can't have sex for 47 days straight, 24 hours a day. So let's take that number, 1,440, let's divide it by 365 to see how many hours a day. That's 3 hours of sex every day, 365 days a year. You know, I like sex a whole lot, but that's too much for me. Can I have my smartphone back, please? Oh, well, let me make it clear that because trees consume so much carbon dioxide, we really do need to be planting a lot more of them. And, you know, using a smartphone instead of having stuff printed out on paper saves a lot of trees. Here's a study that really surprised me, because I thought the conclusions would be just the opposite. Researchers from the UK and Poland and Germany found that when women are competing sexually for a man, they tend to lower their voices. And this is a paper published in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B, and they used speed dating as a way to do their study. You know, we tend to think of women as maybe acting more girlish when they're trying to impress a man, or at least that's probably true with younger women, I thought. But what do I know? It has been a while since I've dated really young women. This looked at 30 participants, okay, tiny, tiny sample again, between the ages of 20 and 40. So the women stayed at their seat and the men traveled to each woman. And each participant made known their receptiveness to each potential partner by marking a yes or no on a questionnaire. And then the whole thing was recorded. So this is what they found when listening to those recordings. They found that men tended to lower their voices when speaking with someone that they would later wind up giving a yes to. Now, that's not surprising. Plenty of studies have shown that men tend to lower their voices when speaking with someone they find sexually attractive. But researchers were quite surprised to find that women were doing the same thing. And yes, there was prior research that tended to suggest that women tended to raise their voices, which I probably encountered at some point, which is why I thought that. But again, just like with the men, they only did this lowering of their voices when it was with a man they were sexually interested in. So, too small a sample size for this to really be a definitive study, and of course you'd have to have follow-up studies that found the same thing, but, you know, still interesting. And finally, we talked last week about the Friday March for Life and some of the bad science, but they also did a poll, and, you know, polls can be scientific or not scientific. In this case, their poll was not scientific. Usually polling on abortion issues is really, really complicated. It all depends upon how you ask the question. The so-called poll came from anti-abortion group Students for Life of America. And in a way, it was kind of a push poll in that they insert fake information into the poll. But an abortion poll is absolutely meaningless when you put in misleading statements. They claimed Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton allow for abortions to be performed in all 9 months of pregnancy up until the moment of birth. They actually don't. And they claim that's the Democratic Party platform. It isn't. They ask about RU486, but the question is framed within a lie about how dangerous it is. They push the right-wing talking point that federally qualified health centers could replace Planned Parenthood clinics when they can't. The results of anything are only as good as your protocols, and here, their protocols were designed to deceive, not to gain knowledge.